that you never go to bed on the first date. It's best to leave some mystery, some anticipation wafting in the air. And the center also preached that time spent being prudent was never time wasted. You don't want to wind up in the false embrace of a double agent. So, in the fall of 1942, on their third get-together, fast work by the puritanical standards of the KGB, the relationship was artfully consummated. In a well-rehearsed argument, Henry complained that America, despite its professed commitment to the Soviet wartime effort, was not sharing its technology with its besieged ally. "I find it unfair that you should be fighting the common enemy alone. If I can do anything to help you, you can count on me," replied Julius Rosenberg, swallowing the dangled hook without hesitation. At their next meet, the novice secret agent delivered his first shipment of purloined documents, and throughout the months ahead he kept at it with unflagging efficiency. By the time his code name had been switched to Liberal, Rosenberg was regularly passing over, according to the boastful Soviet accounts, between 600 and 1,000 pages of often top-secret technical documents at each encounter. Also, himself an intrepid recruiter, he'd built up a valuable network. They were a youthful, largely under 30 group of friends and relations. Each knew the other members in the ring, that is, they were interconscious, as the jargon of his new trade put it, who were, in their zealous hearts, dedicated to the socialistic goals of Mother Russia. And now, as the KGB cable Meredith had deciphered 3 years later had reported, Rosenberg hoped to pull his old school friend and fellow communist, Max Elitcher, into his network of strategically placed idealistic spies. But as Rosenberg, in May 1944, prepared for his recruitment mission in Washington, D.C., Moscow Center, the sternest of employers, had decided he required a new handler. For Liberal, the move was, in its indirect way, a promotion. In recognition of his ring's success, the yield, according to the Center's consistently pleased evaluations, varied from simply good to more often extremely valuable, and with an eye toward an even more promising future, the spymasters decreed that the phlegmatic Henry must be replaced. A more resourceful professional, an agent who would know how to exploit the ring's many burgeoning connections into the defense industry, a case officer who'd inspire the confidence that was necessary for daring undertakings, was needed to run the group. Alexander Feklisov, Sasha, got the job. 19. Sasha prided himself on the calm he showed in the field. He had grown up living by his fists in the hard streets of Workers' Alley, and he didn't fear the dangers that came with his new profession. Let the enemy test him. "If they broke an arm or a rib while they beat me," he'd say, "I'd laugh at their blows." He was confident he could be reduced mentally and physically to the limits of any man's endurance, and yet he would not crack. His death would be his honor. His loyalty to the Center was absolute. Yet Sasha lived with a secret fear that was worse than any physical pain. His greatest anxiety, the imagined death that left his heart racing and had him staring at the ceiling, unable to sleep at 3 a.m., was being outwitted by the opposition and, in the humiliating process, letting the Center down. He still worked under diplomatic cover at the Soviet consulate on East 61st Street in Manhattan, and there was no sign that the FBI had any suspicions that he was anything other than what he pretended to be, and he was determined to keep things that way. Pondering his new assignment, Sasha was, by his own embarrassed admission, nervous. With so much at stake, there was no room for error, for any rash or impetuous move. His tradecraft must be meticulous. But from the start, his concern centered on one large problem. How would he establish contact with this agent? The simplest way would be to call liberal at home. But all his training warned against such an approach. Liberal had access to secret documents. It had to be assumed that the Americans, as a matter of routine security, had a tap on his phone. With a single telephone call, he could wreck a productive network, and in the inevitable aftermath of such a disaster, earn himself a long stay in the Lubyanka basement. No, Sasha decided after some deep thought. The best solution was to meet him at home. He knew better, however, than to rush off and knock on Liberal's door. First, he went to reconnoiter the location. A discreet, no-contact reconnaissance. With a professional, scrupulous eye, he weighed the potential dangers. A busy lower Manhattan street in the long shadow of the Brooklyn Bridge. A dark brick apartment house, Building G, part of a complex of 10-story buildings that made up Knickerbocker Village. Liberal's 3-room apartment was on the 8th floor. Sasha tried to locate its windows. And there was the building's lobby. To enter, a code needed to be punched, or one used the intercom and asked to be buzzed in. It was a setting that, in its unextraordinary way, was like much of this low-rent residential neighborhood in New York's Lower East Side. A community whose streets were alive with families striving to make ends meet, constant big city hustle and bustle, and streams of immigrants firmly tied to their old country ways, muttering a cacophony of languages. Yet for Sasha, an agent behind enemy lines, it held countless perils, provoked a constant wariness. No field man heads out on an operation without his active mind warning that at any moment, something unexpected can happen, that around the next corner a trap could be sprung. Sasha nevertheless formulated his plan, and Kvasnikov signed off on it. It was, in its direct way, nearly as matter-of-fact as a telephone call. He'd go to Liberal's apartment unannounced at 2 on a Sunday afternoon. It was a time when Sasha imagined he'd find him home. Then he'd quickly introduce himself. "I come from Henry." It would work. Yet, just as likely, a dozen things could go wrong. He tried to find solace in the disturbing truth that his two brothers, infantrymen in the Red Army, faced greater risks each day on the battlefield. "What," he asked himself in an attempt to add fuel to his flickering courage, "was I doing that was so dangerous in the peaceful traffic of the New York streets?" On the day of the meet, with his mood shifting each mercurial moment from stiff confidence to the certainty of impending doom, he left his apartment on West 89th Street an hour and a half ahead of his predetermined schedule. He strolled down Central Park West, the image, he hoped, of a man enjoying a pleasant New York Sunday. Then he suddenly bolted across the street, weaving through the traffic as enraged drivers honked their horns and slammed on their brakes. This was, he'd boast, his favorite move. It allowed you to see, without showing it, what the situation around you looks like. After taking stock and finding no apparent cause for alarm, he continued on foot to Columbus Circle, where he boarded a downtown subway train. He rode it down to Little Italy, all the time trying to catch a purposeful glance from one of the opposition's watchers. No one had been flushed, but Sasha felt he couldn't be sure that he hadn't missed something. He took a diversionary bus back uptown to Grand Central. Grabbing a hot dog from a vendor inside the terminal, he gobbled it down without interest while his eyes scanned the crowd for the telltale signs of people loitering artlessly about. He saw nothing suspicious. With his rumbling doubts now somewhat at rest, he boarded a downtown bus, got off at Rivington Street, and, following the sidewalk at a sedate pace, arrived at the entrance of Liberal's building at 2 p.m. to the minute. He pushed the intercom button. "Yes?" questioned a man's voice. "Hello," said Sasha with all the authority he could muster. "I'm looking for Julius Rosenberg." "That's me." "I'm a friend of Henry's," he announced. May I come up for a minute? The door buzzed open, and Sasha headed to the elevator. The ride to the 8th floor was its own heart-pounding adventure. If Liberal had been doubled, if, despite all Sasha's caution, he'd been followed, an army of FBI agents might be waiting to greet him. The door opened, and there was Julius Rosenberg, a skinny man with black hair and a wispy mustache, staring at him mournfully through a bookkeeper's steel-rimmed glasses. He was alone. His firm handshake was further reassurance. Without prelude, Sasha dived in. "I'm the one who will come to see you from now on," he said. Rosenberg calmly absorbed the news, and when he spoke, his words did not betray his feelings. Instead, apparently resigned to the change, he offered his new handler a terse apology. "Excuse me, but I can't let you come in. We're entertaining a couple of friends." Together they walked down the 8 flights of stairs to the lobby, talking all the time, their voices holding a normal pitch. If someone entered the stairwell, whispers would have attracted suspicions. It was agreed that they would meet next Tuesday at Child's, a decidedly proletarian restaurant on West 34th Street, where the Blue Plate Special was famously a stolid rectangle of gray meat doused in a brackish gravy. The menu insisted it was Salisbury steak. The rendezvous was set for 7:30 p.m., since Rosenberg worked during the day. Sasha had a final word. He instructed his new agent not to bring any stolen papers with him. A first meet, the rigid protocols of good conspiratia insisted, should be an occasion where both handler and his new charge take full measure of one another. After all, when your life is at stake, you'd better be able to trust the man with whom you're working. Tuesday evening, across the narrow table at Child's, after Sasha made the requisite toast to his companion and to the success of their future collaboration, he proceeded to the next item on his checklist. The Moscow Center psychologists wanted him to open his heart, believing that candor cemented allegiance. Finding the confiding tone that had won over a small legion of previous Joes, as handlers uniformly referred to their agents, Sasha spoke about his down-at-the-heels childhood in Moscow, his worries about his brothers at the front, his sisters digging trenches at Bryansk, directly in the thundering path of the advancing German forces. Rosenberg reciprocated with confidences about his adored wife. He closed his eyes and blew a kiss into his hand when he spoke about her, and his young son. A second boy would be born in 1948. In that way, a product of shrewd manipulation, a shared antipathy toward Nazism, and a common faith in the Soviet socialistic ideals, a bond grew. The two men would meet about 50 times over the next 3 years, passing documents on rush-hour buses, at a boxing match in Madison Square Garden, at restaurants and on street corners in Manhattan, the Bronx, and Brooklyn. Sasha provided Rosenberg with a Leica, carrying a special lens devised by Moscow Center and shipped over in the diplomatic pouch. The focal length of the lens could be expanded, and that made microfilming documents a perfunctory exercise. The eager agent photographed everything that came his way, and his yield continued to fill the center's coffers. His dedication was such, his desire to do more was so strong, that Sasha had to hold him back. Rosenberg routinely took risks that his handler begged him not to take. In the course of their work together, they became, as Sasha grew to appreciate, a real team. Sasha was the professional, but time after time he conceded operational details to the agent. He knew his own country, his fellow citizens, their frame of mind and their reactions in workplaces far better than I did. And another rarity in a harsh world where agent runners value success far higher than any inhibiting concerns about their Joe's safety, Sasha could not help liking Liberal. He took to calling him by the affectionate nickname of Libby, an intimacy that would have shocked his stern bosses. And what did Rosenberg get out of all this? Once, above the concealing din of a crowded cafeteria, he shared more of a clue to what was driving him than his usual homilies about the war-beleaguered Soviet state and his sanguine visions of the Marxist-Leninist paradise that would come to pass in the future. "I know you may not be aware of it," he confessed to Sasha, "but our meetings are among the happiest moments of all my life. I have a wonderful wife and a son whom I adore, but you are the only person who knows all my secrets, and it's very important to be able to confide to someone." And so it happened that Liberal confided to his handler one more secret, the details of his own attempted recruitment of Max Elitcher. It was a brief report, as summaries of failed missions tend to be. But to Libby's credit, Sasha thought, he told it with the stoicism of someone who remained unprepared to give up. Rosenberg had telephoned Elitcher, whom he had seen only once in the 5 years since their graduation from college, and asked if he could come over to say hello. Signal Corps business had brought him to Washington, he'd lied. There was some talk over coffee in Elitcher's apartment, all sounding even to Rosenberg's own ears embarrassingly forced. So, abandoning whatever small pretense remained of this being merely a casual visit, he bluntly asked his school friend's wife if she would be kind enough to give him a few minutes alone with her husband. Once she left, he made his pitch. Rosenberg had two cards to play, and he laid them both out with a succinct yet earnest passion. He began, as Elitcher would remember the conversation, by highlighting the great role Russia was playing in the war and the great sacrifice she was making. Then he quickly followed with the revelation that some persons were contributing to the Russian war effort by giving secret material and developments to the Russians, which they would not ordinarily receive. The pointed way he said it left little doubt that by some persons he meant himself and some of their mutual city college friends. He asked if Max would contribute in this way, too. Rosenberg, by now a veteran recruiter, knew this was the most dangerous moment. A person could say yes, he could say no, or, a secret hero in his heart, he might pick up the phone and call the FBI 2 minutes after you left. It was always difficult to predict how someone would respond to the question of whether he'd betray his country. Yet Elitcher said neither yes nor no. He was firmly noncommittal. But he certainly didn't seem as if he'd be running to the FBI. Rosenberg later told Sasha that it would just take some time. He'd try Elitcher again. "I trust your judgment," Sasha said with a genuine confidence. When Rosenberg made a second approach to Elitcher, now over a dinner in Manhattan at Manny Wolf's, the result was more of the same indecision. Only this go-around, Rosenberg had his own second thoughts. "Elitcher has changed," he reported to Sasha. Sasha was concerned enough about this change to share his anxieties with his superior, and Kvasnikov, another professional, agreed. He, too, was at once on alert. "Forget about Elitcher," Sasha told his agent at their next meet. "It's not that important." His instructions, while in order, were offered with an apparent indifference. He chose a casual, even convivial tone. He did not wish to share that he was thinking of a future that he didn't want his agent to dare imagine. He did not explain that in Elitcher's sudden transformation he had a premonition, still faint, still instinctive, of the enemy one day closing in. But as things would work out for Liberal and his ring, perhaps he should have. 20. But Bob, setting out on his hunt nearly 3 years later, had no knowledge of these events. He was ignorant of the drama that had taken place between Elitcher and Liberal, or the puppet-master role Sasha had played in the wings. Yet using just the thin clues in the deciphered cable sent back in 1944, a lifetime of secrets ago, he feared, he went on the offensive. His first step was to try to mobilize the Bureau, again. Bob was well aware of the irony in this attempt. It wasn't that long ago that he'd been the salesman trying to convince a disinterested Meredith that the FBI could offer the codebreaker a wealth of deductive resources. Now he'd be going to the Bureau, trying one more time to stir them out of their doldrums, and his best argument was the promise in the leads Meredith had uncovered. A further complicating wrinkle. He could not reveal either the source of the information or how it had been obtained. The most he could do, he'd decided after some tortured pondering, was attribute the clue to a confidential informant of known reliability. At least that euphemism, while modest, would be an accurate description of Meredith and his conjurer's skills. Nevertheless, as Bob prepared to go, fedora in hand, and try one more time to rally his bosses to the chase, he felt surprisingly prepared to take on the dismissive arguments he fully expected to hear. A large contributing factor to his buoyant mood, he later confided to intimates, was that the ambiguity in his married life had been, for now at least, resolved. A son, George, had been born, and in their joy both he and Sarah had found reason for a renewed commitment to family happiness. Yet too often Bob would find himself looking at the innocent baby boy, and his thoughts, like a recurring nightmare, would slink away to Enormos and the dangerous world in which George would grow up. In that driven yet remarkably steady mood, Bob burst into Al Belmont's office. Belmont was the assistant director of domestic intelligence, and, Bob would say, FBI through and through. On some days that description was meant as high praise, the recognition that Belmont shared Bob's steely commitment to bringing all the villains to justice. On others, especially when Bob was seething after his exertions trudging through the bureaucratic morass, it could just as easily mean that Belmont was reluctant to authorize any innovative action. That day, Bob could only make his case as forcefully as the expurgated facts would allow, and then wait to see which version of the assistant director was sitting behind his impressive desk. Belmont answered without hesitation. "Bob, we're going to increase the number of guys on your unit." "Who are you kidding?" Bob shot back, incredulous. He girded himself for a knockdown brawl, and, deprived of this opportunity, he compensated by not taking yes for an answer. "What do you mean, who are we kidding?" "It doesn't work that way." "You know damn well it doesn't work that way, Al." Now it was Belmont's voice that rose suddenly in anger. "God damn it, Bob, I just told you. You name them, we'll get them." Bob named them, and within days, still not quite believing his unexpectedly easy victory, he got them. The hand-picked force, although tied to their desks in the SE unit at headquarters, hit the ground running. On Bob's instructions, they reached out to both the Washington and New York field offices and ordered an investigation into Max Elitcher. The priority telex was headed, again on Bob's say-so, Espionage R. R stood for Russian, and he could only hope that the designation would spur on the men in the trenches. No sooner had Elitcher's name gone into the system than lights might just as well have started flashing. The request, Bob was stiffly informed, was redundant. The Bureau was already looking into Elitcher. Only, rather than being reassuring, this news filled Bob with a new dread. The facts that were shared were these. Back in 1941, gimlet-eyed naval intelligence investigators had spotted Elitcher and a fellow Navy employee, Morton Sobel, packing demonstrators into Sobel's car to ferry them to an anti-draft rally sponsored by the American Peace Mobilization Committee. Since there were several Communist Party members sprinkled throughout the committee's leadership hierarchy, the Navy sleuths wondered if the two men, both of whom had access to military secrets, were also party members. The FBI was brought in to conduct a loyalty check. The Bureau's background investigation had meandered along over the years. It had never determined if, in fact, the two men were Communist Party members, which could have resulted in a perjury case, since both had sworn they were not when they'd started working for the Navy. All they had come up with was that Elitcher and Sobel had both attended City College from 1934 to 1938, and that they had roomed together for a while in Washington. Then the investigation had petered out. Besides, while Elitcher had continued to work for the Navy during the war, Sobel had moved on, first to the General Electric Laboratories in Schenectady, New York, and more recently joining the Reeves Instrument Company in New York City. But these small pickings were enough for Bob nearly to scream, "Stop!" No sooner had the word come back to him at headquarters that the Bureau's inquiry into Elitcher was, technically at least, still on an active footing, that he sent down the order that rather than gearing things up again, the investigation should come to an immediate halt. He didn't explain his decision to the agents in the field offices. For all they knew, this was just one more example of the supervisors at headquarters running hot one day and cold the next. To his own team, however, he revealed a bit more of his thinking. A reinvigorated loyalty check, talking to neighbors, to bosses, could scare the prey, he explained. Elitcher would learn, as targets invariably do, that questions were being asked, and he'd bolt. If Elitcher was a Russian spy, the investigation had to be handled with extraordinary care. The operational goal was to catch him in the act, stealing documents, passing these secrets to his handler, and that would require far more tactful strategy. Bob issued a new set of orders. With the discreet cooperation of the post office, a mail cover went into effect. Photocopies of the outside of all envelopes and postcards mailed to Elitcher's apartment arrived on Bob's desk before they were delivered. A record of Elitcher's long-distance calls was obtained, and agents began combing through them, hoping to find something that might catch their interest. And after weighing the matter, Bob finally decided to order visual surveillance on Elitcher. Bob knew the Bureau's watchers were of variable quality. There was always the chance Elitcher might catch on. But he judged the risks to be worth it. The prospects of nabbing an active Soviet agent in the act were too enticing. Yet even as he shared all this with his men, there was something that he kept buried deep. It was an investigative secret to which only he and Meredith were privy. Because all the time that he was running his bandstand operation, to use the watcher's term for round-the-clock scrutiny, his own thoughts were fixed on Sobel. He made the connection between the school friend who lived in Carthage in the deciphered cable and the scant but confirming details unearthed in the Bureau's background investigation, and he wondered if he had found a talent spotter and a leader of a Soviet spy network. Was Morton Sobel antenna liberal? A brush pass, as Sasha's tradecraft instructor at the KGB training school in Balashika had lectured, offered many operational advantages for the clandestine transfer of small objects. Even if the opposition surveillance team was breathing down your neck, the skillful agent could still pull off an exchange without being detected. The maneuver's success, however, required that the field man obey certain rules. The delivery should occur only in a crowd. The two agents must never look each other in the eye. And, this one etched in stone at the top of the list, Don't stop walking. Like a baton in a relay race, the pass from one hand to another must be done in a flash with no one breaking stride. Over the years, Sasha had perfected this covert art, and it had become his preferred procedure for collecting palm-sized canisters of microfilm from his Joes. And so, every month or so since he had taken over the Liberal Network, walking with seemingly aimless intention through the bustling lunchtime or rush-hour streets of Midtown Manhattan, he'd receive a roll of film from the agent codenamed Senya. Codenames are usually bestowed with the tricky intent of adding one more misleading clue to an agent's identity. Hence, a tall man would be called Dwarf. The rotund spy might be Thin Man. Senya meant God heard me in Russian, and Sasha reflected that for once the KGB's covert shorthand was accurate. Senya was a most productive asset, an answer to all the center's prayers. He had been recruited by Rosenberg in 1944, and his yield, year after year, had continued with an impressive fecundity. He had consistently delivered documents praised as very valuable by the center, thousands of pages of secrets about sonar, infrared rays, and missile guidance systems. The classified reports he'd passed on from the U.S. government's Coordinating Committee for Radio Technology revealed precisely what the nation's scientists knew, and, of even greater interest to the Russians, what they were aiming to accomplish in the future. Morton Sobel, codenamed Senya, was not the ringleader Bob had been hunting. He was just one more of Liberal's well-placed recruits, another spy in the bread-and-butter operation Sasha was coolly running with remarkable efficiency. Yet as Bob struggled to get a context for the new clues that were coming his way, he was summoned once again by Meredith. Another cable had been deciphered and, Meredith soberly hedged, he might just be jumping at shadows. But then again, it could take them straight into the very operational heart of the Ring of Spies. 21. It was not in Meredith's nature to appear pleased with himself. In public he was far too modest, while in private he was too self-assured to portray his shrewd feats as anything more than natural for a man who was a legend. Still, when Bob arrived at his friend's desk and Meredith handed over his latest decryption, the FBI agent couldn't help but feel that for once he detected a small glimmer of professional pride in his colleague's smile. And while that might have been so, what was also animating Meredith, as he'd explain when the passing years had provided him with additional insight, was that he, too, had become caught up in the thrill of the hunt. Before he'd teamed up with Bob, his sedentary and thoroughly fulfilling existence had been measured out in academic challenges. He had thought the trajectory of his life and career had been long settled. But, like the happily married man whose world is turned inside out by an unexpected passion, Meredith's dalliance with Bob had given him a fresh perspective on things. In this second spring, he discovered that he enjoyed the relevance of his new, consequential life. Every day he grappled with puzzles that brought him deep into a real-world mystery. The words that, after all his painstaking labors, took shape on his worksheets, were not merely nouns or verbs, but clues to a ring of spies. And all the while, spurring him on, thoughts of enormous, of the precarious balance of international power being upended, were never far from the center of his mind. That afternoon there was still a bit of pedantry in the report he shared with Bob. Otvod, Meredith had written, carefully transliterating the cable's Cyrillic, means recruitment in KGB parlance. Similarly, the verb otvesti would mean to recruit. But all this was simply prelude, and a stagey one at that, to his big reveal. He reported that Moscow Center had been notified back in 1944, 4 long years earlier, that Liberal also had his eyes on another recruit. His name, Saint-Enclair, was Joel Barr. Bob listened, and now it was his turn to experience a sudden burst of encouragement. He had begun with Max Elitcher, who had brought him to Morton Sobel, and here was another rich clue, Joel Barr. Bob knew, of course, that this was just more of the beginning. He remained at the starting gate and had no notion of how far off in the distance the finish line was. At this point, Barr was only one of Liberal's targets. Bob had no knowledge of whether he'd become part of the ring. His investigation, woefully preliminary, further handicapped because the deciphered cables recorded events that had taken place years earlier, had not yet allowed him to draw any of the firm connective lines that he'd need to guide him in the summer of 1948 to the mysterious Liberal, the ringleader. And it was so far only his conjectures that had tied the ring into the enemy's theft of atomic secrets. But now that he possessed another name, he felt the plot had considerably thickened. For a counterintelligence man, it was a golden time. I could look ahead and see us coming closer and closer, not only to Russian agents whose trails the intervening years had muddied, but also to spies who were actually still at work among us. Nevertheless, in the long nights that followed, while he lay in his bed in Maryland, surrounded by darkness and his unsettled thoughts, Bob had trouble sleeping. In his bedroom, away from the activity at headquarters, his conferences with the uncanny Meredith a receding blur, he found his optimism harder to sustain. He feared the enemy was beyond his reach, and always would be. But in the restorative light of day, there was an investigation to run, and, seemingly unencumbered by any of his nocturnal doubts, he threw himself into it. Even as the operational wheels still turned on Elitcher and Sobel, he focused his attention on Barr. Meredith had given him reason to suspect that Barr would lead to Liberal. Perhaps Barr even was Liberal, the busy anchor of the ring. And so Bob took a gamble. Ignoring the concerns of his circumspect bosses on the fifth floor, and skirting very close to the edge of the agreement he'd made with the brass at Arlington Hall, when he turned his men loose on the new target, he pretty much let them know what was at stake. He believed the agents in the field would be more diligent if they had some sense of the prize. The formal request for information he sent through the FBI pipeline was headed, Joel Barr and Unsub, the designation Bureau speak for unknown subject. And while Bob knew better than to reveal the code name Liberal, or how he had learned of the ring's existence, he nevertheless lifted the cloak of official secrecy to share what this Unsub was involved in. Barr, he wrote in his accompanying report, possibly acted as an intermediary between person or persons who were working on wartime nuclear fission research and for KGB agents. When the fifth floor got wind of Bob's indiscretion, they went into full damage control mode. A bristling directive went out under Hoover's signature to the field offices, ordering that no further references were to be made to the Unsub for security reason. And as for Bob, he received an official reprimand. But Bob quickly forgot about this administrative slap on the wrist as the field reports poured in. Pieced together, they formed an intriguing story. Barr had an electrical engineering degree from City College, same as Elitcher Sobel, and if the clues were pointing in the right direction, Liberal. He'd also been a member of Branch 16B of the Industrial Division of the Communist Party, and so he'd been a fellow countryman, same as all the other potential recruits in the ring. His employment history set off even more alarms. Barr had worked at the U.S. Army Signal Corps Laboratories in Fort Monmouth, New Jersey, only to lose his job when the army learned about his communist ties. Still, he was quickly hired by Western Electric, a major defense contractor, where he helped develop a classified radar bombsight for B-29s. And after the war, he'd moved on to become a project engineer at Sperry Gyroscope, working daily with Information Secret and Unlimited. Just as the New York Residentura had boasted in its cable about Elitcher, so too did Barr have access to extremely valuable materials. Adding it all up, Bob moved toward a confident conclusion. Barr had all the makings of another member of the well-placed ring. His burrowers had dug up something else that caught Bob's interest. When Barr had worked at the Signal Corps lab, his close friend had been Alfred Sarant. Sarant had graduated from the Cooper Union, not CCNY, like all the other suspects. But Sarant had also been a member of Barr's Communist Party cell, and when he, too, had been dismissed from the Army lab, he'd also found a job at Western Electric. His work was focused on APQ-17, a secret airborne radar system being developed for the military. And during their wartime bachelor days, Barr and Sarant had shared an apartment on Morton Street in Greenwich Village. All of which, Bob readily conceded, proved nothing. It was a biography that could have no intelligence value. Or, as his professional's hunch shouted, Sarant's life had been too closely cut from the same cloth as Elitcher's and Barr's not to have attracted the attentions of the ring's KGB talent spotter. When Bob shared all this with Meredith, the codebreaker felt enough had been unearthed to allow him to return to old mysteries and tackle things from another vantage point. He tracked back over the messages he'd already broken, and, armed with this new knowledge, something caught his eye. In one of the early messages sent from the New York Residentura to Moscow, back in the spring of 1944, there had been a reference to a pair of friends. Liberal, the cable informed the center, has safely carried through the contracting of Hughes, who was a good friend of Meter. At the time, Meredith had no doubt that by contracting, the KGB meant recruiting. But he'd been totally stymied by the cover names Hughes and Meter. The only clue he'd had during his first go-round was their friendship. Now, extrapolating from the fresh intelligence Bob had gathered, he felt he had the kernels of a budding theory. It went like this. In early 1944, Meter had preceded Hughes into the ring. At least that was how Meredith read the cable. And since Barr, like Elitcher, and quite possibly Liberal, had been school friends, then, QED, Barr equals Meter. Which meant that Sarant, the new acquaintance who'd earned his degree at another college and would have needed to have been introduced to old-school pal Liberal, was Hughes. This supposition became arguably more solid, and certainly more menacing, after Meredith managed to break down a fragment of another message between New York and Moscow, sent on December 5, 1944. Expedite consent to joint filming of their materials by Meter and Hughes. It was a request that made further operational sense if, like Barr and Sarant, the two operatives were not only best friends, but also shared an apartment. And the cable's concluding sentence made it disturbingly clear why Moscow needed to give the okay for the two agents to film their yield sooner rather than later. We are afraid of putting Liberal out of action with overwork. The case, once filled with only imponderables, was now taking firmer shape in Bob's mind. He believed that his gut instincts and Meredith's hypothesis were parts of the same whole. It was time, he decided, to see how it all might hold up if he brought Barr in for questioning. Only now he couldn't find him. Sperry Gyroscope had finally gotten around to doing their own background check on the engineer, and when Barr's communist affiliations became known, he was stripped of his security clearance and days later fired. Barr, according to what the New York field office unearthed, had realized his days of getting work in the defense industry were over. Reluctant to endure years of unemployment in America, he had decided to reinvent himself. The story he told acquaintances was that he was going to Paris to study piano. Bob needed to know more. On his orders, the New York office dispatched an earnestly fulsome agent to make contact with Barr's mother. Trotting out the thin cover story that he was a school friend of Joel's, the agent asked the unsuspecting woman where he might find his old buddy. Her amused response was that his guess was as good as hers. The last she had heard, her son was traveling through Finland, playing the piano to support himself. When Bob read the report, he promptly felt that all his suspicions had been confirmed. Finland was just a short hop from the Russian border, and it was precisely the sort of circuitous itinerary an agent would follow as he made his covert way to his Moscow Center spymasters. It was a journey that would end with his disappearing without a trace. Bob was stymied. He had neither the resources nor the authority to track down Barr now that he was abroad. All he could do was pass on a heavily censored explanation of his interest in Barr to the CIA. Perhaps they might be able to pick up his trail. As for Sarant, Bob had nothing on him. No, he glumly realized, less than nothing. The decrypts were thin gruel. The messages had been sent 4 years earlier. Worse, they couldn't be introduced as evidence in court. Further, whatever leverage he might once have had was gone. Sarant had left Defense Department work for the groves of academe, teaching physics at Cornell. As for his being Barr's friend and roommate, well, even the ever-condemnatory Hoover, Bob admitted, couldn't begin to make a federal case out of that. What, Bob glumly asked himself, had he accomplished? So far, he'd say in answer to his own troubling question, the inquiries have been tantalizing but inconclusive. Both Elitcher and Barr might have been spies in 1944, or neither of them might ever have been a spy. While Bob could only wonder, Sasha knew the truth. And what he knew had kept him for years in a constant state of high alert. Barr and Sarant, Meter and Hughes, as Meredith had accurately surmised, had been a reckless pair of spies. They had continually broken the most basic rules of operational security. Danger, Sasha, their beleaguered case agent, would moan, was never very far away. His steady fears were further compounded by his helplessness. His two young charges refused to obey his orders. The problem was sex. Now, Sasha was no prude. He was married and had a young daughter, but it had not been that many years ago when he'd been a footloose bachelor. More to the point, he knew firsthand about ill-advised romances. While he'd been stationed at the center's spy school, he had entered into a risky arrangement with a certain Lydia, who taught English. She was 6 years older and about to marry a divorced university professor. Yet Lydia feared that if on her wedding night her new husband discovered she was still, at the ripe age of 32, a virgin, he might reevaluate his infatuation. Why should he want what no other man had wanted in all these years? And so Lydia focused her attentions on handsome Sasha, and the would-be spy, despite the explicit prohibition against fraternization between teachers and students, responded with an ardor that she apparently found a revelation. Their liaisons continued even after Lydia had returned from her honeymoon. It was Lydia, with her more mature practicality, who finally ended it. "I do hope that you did not lose anything because of our affair," she told the secret agent in training as she waved goodbye. Looking back at the experience, Sasha knew he'd dodged a bullet. If the spymasters at Moscow Center had known what had been going on, his career would have ended before his first mission. But that was nothing when measured against what Meter and Hughes were jeopardizing by their parade of one-night stands. Every time the two young Lotharios entertained the latest in a series of seemingly unending conquests, they put the entire liberal network at risk. The honey trap was one of the oldest tricks in the counterintelligence agent's book, and, Sasha had been taught, one of the enemy's favorites. In the bedroom, even the most prudent spy was bound to let his guard down. There were few secrets in a double bed. Sasha lived in a state of perpetual anxiety that one or perhaps both of his agents would reveal something as he lay next to a woman he'd met earlier that night in a village bar, and that with the new day, the FBI would be hot on their trail. But while it was a genuine cause for concern when your agents were spending their nights with a chorus line of strangers, it was a complete five-alarm disaster when the Love Nest was also their operational headquarters. Barr had a makeshift darkroom in the two-room apartment, where he routinely photographed and then developed both his and Sarant's hall. The best Sasha could do to ensure some small measure of security was to come by the apartment and work with Barr to find hiding places for the tools of his secret trade. Together they pried up a few floorboards and cached the camera and its accessories in one spot, the rolls of microfilm in another. Still, it was just rudimentary tradecraft, and Sasha could not help fearing that it was only a matter of time before the FBI came crashing through the door of the Morton Street flat. There was, however, one saving grace, and it was a substantial reward that put all the risks in perspective. Once a month, Barr would slip Sasha a package containing about 20 exposed rolls of film, a total of between 400 and 500 pages of often highly classified defense-related material. On other occasions, he'd provide the photographs of the actual documents. Even better, the two spies were remarkably prescient. Without needing to be told, they seemed to know what their masters were hoping for. For example, early one morning over a coffee in the Residentura, Sasha read a cable detailing the center's latest urgent request. Just outside London, an ultra-modern device, the SCR-584, automatically determines the speed and path of German V-2 rockets and sets the firing of anti-aircraft batteries. Take every step to obtain more information on this facility. The next day at 7 a.m., Sasha was sitting with Barr in a midtown cafeteria when he passed his agent a slip of paper describing what the center wanted. Barr read it, and then offered a small, cryptic smile that left his handler perplexed. But in the next satisfying moment, the mystery was solved. "That's funny," Meter said. "We must have a crystal ball. 5 days ago we read your minds and got the technical manual of this facility. We finished photographing it last night at 2 a.m. There are 600 pages of texts and drawings." He passed Sasha several canisters of film under the table. 2 days later, the films traveled in the diplomatic pouch to Moscow. And 1 week after the cable had been sent, the much-desired documents were on Pavel Fitin's desk in the Lubyanka. As long as the flow of product remained constant, and of such high quality, Sasha felt he had no choice but to resign himself to the risks created by his two agents' imprudent behavior. But all the while, Sasha couldn't help pondering how much longer they'd be able to continue to get away with leading their secret lives, or if the entire network would soon come crashing down. 22. Even today there remains some mystery as to why Meredith, at this point in the investigation, decided to replow old ground. At least one of the intelligence historians who reviewed the files insists it was simply Meredith's new knowledge about the relationship between Meter and Hughes that had sent him scurrying back on this detour. This explanation is further bolstered by the undeniable fact that Meter is specifically mentioned in the cable to which Meredith's attention returned. Yet there is another school of thought that suggests the revelations in the first flurry of decryptions that had set up the two spies as friends working in tandem had little to do with Meredith's next move. Totally irrelevant, they huff. In fact, they assert, it's impossible to gauge with any kind of accuracy how a unique mind like Meredith's worked. Genius, they point out with an argument-ending smugness, has its own intuitive logic. Still, whatever the reason, it is a matter of record that even as the Bureau continued its pursuit of several targets, from his desk at Arlington Hall, Meredith issued a new special study. It was titled, Revised Translation of Message on Antenna Liberal's Wife Ethel. Further work on this message has so improved the text, began Meredith, for once taking the slightest self-congratulatory bow, that a revised translation is in order. His new version of the cable sent on November 27, 1944, from the New York station to Moscow Center now read, Intelligence on Liberal's Wife. Surname, that of her husband. Christian name, Ethel, 29 years old. Married 5 years. Finished middle school. A fellow countryman in 1938. Sufficiently well-developed politically. She knows about her husband's work and the role of Meter and Nil. In view of her delicate health, does not work. Meredith's second go-round did not shed any further light on Meter, the man Bob was convinced was Joel Barr. And Nil still remained a complete and total puzzle. The agent's identity was as impenetrable as it had been in the earlier translation. Nevertheless, Meredith believed he had found something he'd previously missed. It was a clue that took him deeper into the inner machinery of Liberal's ring, and to an understanding of the role of Liberal's wife. The key was a single verb. Meredith, a linguist in his previous life, who still felt on firmest ground when dealing with syntactical notions, had initially zeroed in on the use of the verb work in the message. The word in Russian, «работает», had, Meredith had recently grown certain, a special meaning in the cable. It referred, he wrote in his report, to «conspiratorial work in the interests of the USSR», and therefore the sentence, «in view of her delicate health, does not work», took on a special meaning too. In the same way, Meredith reasoned, the work that Ethel cannot do in view of her delicate health may not be the earning of her bread and butter, but conspiratorial work. With that deduction, the network of spies took on a greater physical shape. There was the ringleader and talent spotter, Liberal. There were agents, productive operatives like Meter and Hughes. And then there was the headman's wife, Christian name Ethel, who was apparently fully cognizant of what was going on, but at the same time stood on the sideline. Does not work. A passive spectator to the treason being played out around her. For Bob, the inveterate case man, there was little appreciation of his friend's semantic feat. He had no time for digressions into the use of Russian nouns and verbs. The knowledge Bob took from the revised translation was purely tactical. He had a new unsub, a woman, and she was at the very heart of the ring. Once again, cavalierly ignoring the restrictions both Arlington Hall and his superiors in the Bureau had placed on the investigation, he let the field offices know why he was so keen on tracking her down. Like Barr, she was thought to have acted as an intermediary between person or persons who were working on wartime nuclear fission research and for KGB agents. Bob reasoned that if he nabbed Christian name Ethel, and if in the process she led him to liberal, then let the bosses come gunning for him. He'd have something to shut them up, all right. In his obstinate way,